This is 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. On today's edition of Jaws of Justice Radio, we start out with a speech by our own Keith Brown L., given last September at the annual statewide meeting of Missouri Cure, followed by a commentary from Behind the Walls by Kay Ray. In place of our calendar of events, we will be talking with Laura McDonald, Executive Director of Moore Squared, about their efforts in the Missouri Legislature. Then, in the second half of our show, Liz Henry and Cassandra Mitchell talk with filmmaker Greg Williams about his film, The Anonymous People, and his personal story of recovering from addiction. And, as always, the 420 Drug War News after the show. Now, here's Keith, formerly incarcerated citizen, activist, radio host, and vice president of Missouri Cure.
Good morning and welcome to Missouri Cure's 10th annual statewide conference. And for those of you who don't know, the word Cure is an acronym for Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants. My name is Keith Brown, as she just told you, and my presentation is entitled, Anything That Doesn't Kill You Is Supposed to Make You Stronger. It is a commentary about how I survived for 36 years while doing time in the Department of Correction, and it is also a tribute to all of the men and women who are still locked up and serving time. I am told that there is a sign etched in stone in the administration building of the Missouri State Penitentiary that reads, Leave all hope behind. I don't recall seeing that sign when I arrived there in 1972, yet I can tell you that if you ever had the misfortune of being incarcerated at that institution, it wasn't necessary for you to see the sign. All you had to do is sit there on the bus and just look at those guard towers and those stone white walls, and the message would definitely come through loud and clear. I only had a 15-year sentence when I stepped out of the vehicle that brought me in handcuffs and shackles to that terrible place. I felt like a runaway slave being delivered into the custody of a slave plantation owner. And the reality is that I was. The 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude except as punishment for a crime shall exist within the United States or any place subject to its jurisdiction. When I entered MSP, I was only 2 years older than the amount of time I had actually been sentenced to serve. I had no idea I'd still be in the Department of Corrections so many years later. All I knew was that I was in trouble. And the only thing I could do is not go in there looking for trouble, but to make sure that trouble was going to be in trouble too if trouble came looking for me. Well, trouble did come and find me. Not once, not twice, but far too many times. And that is why I ended up being incarcerated 21 years longer than I was supposed to be. I will never forget this old man who took a liking to me. Every time I got out of disciplinary segregation, he used to shake his head and look at me and say, Youngster, you are never going to wear this penitentiary out. The only thing it's going to do is wear you out. And if you don't believe that, just wait and see. Well, if I did wear it out, it wasn't like I didn't try. But the Missouri State Penitentiary was eventually closed down by the Missouri Legislature in 2004. By that time, it had taken out my life most of the 36 years I was eventually served. I don't mind telling you that prison also left me with quite a few battle scores, both physical and mental. But this place, the Missouri State Penitentiary, also destroyed the lives of a lot of other men, both good and bad. So, for the purpose of reflection, I have made several journeys back to MSP over the years since it has been closed. I did this because, to some people, the Missouri State Penitentiary was a symbol of defeat and death. Yet to me, it was a symbol of my victory and strength. This is why every time I see it now, I just look at it and smile. I smile because I knew it was once a very bad place to be. But the bottom line, it wasn't bad to me because I made it out there alive and hope. When they finally did close it down, I was still standing. I was still ready to get in a good fight. And I couldn't care less what that damn sign said in MSP because I still had all my hopes and dreams. When I first went into the DOC, they only had 7 institutions. They've got 14 additional prisons now. That's 21 altogether. To me, that means every time the DOC opened another penitentiary, it increased my chances of dying in one of those places. And each new institution symbolized one more additional year added to my original sentence. MSP was the godfather of all other institutions. It always has been, and it always will be. But it was the environment that carried the message, leave all your hopes behind, not the sign that was out in front of the place. And that message and that mentality is still present in every institution to this very day, regardless of whether you see a sign there or not. The most terrifying thing about dealing with people who have been in prison is not that they have committed a crime, but that they carry the stigma of having been in prison in the first place. If you spend years out of your life living in an environment full of dangerous people, society is naturally going to assume that you are also a dangerous person. I believe this is because even while we invest enormous sums of money in prison rehabilitation, most people feel in their subconscious minds that rehabilitation is a myth. They believe that if a person wasn't already bad enough before you went into one of those places, that they're going to be even worse whenever they come out. In a lot of cases, this is true, but it's not because people can't actually be rehabilitated. It is because the people who are charged with the responsibility of rehabilitation are either incompetent or they have no desire to see people like myself get out of prison and be successful. Normally, you will find that if given a chance to be a better person, most people who have been to prison will usually try to avail themselves of that opportunity. I know I can certainly appreciate being in that kind of situation. You see, in prison, every time I had a problem with somebody, I had to be ready to throw up my hands or be ready to pick up a knife. Out here on the street, I can usually fight my battles with intelligence. And that is far more convenient because there's no bloodshed, no physical retaliation, pending criminal charges, or additional prison time. It does make a lot of sense to learn how to handle situations in this manner. Otherwise, you won't be out here on the street for very long. That is why I tell people all the time, my rehabilitation didn't start until I was released from prison. When I was in jail, I didn't have time to be rehabilitated. I spent all of my days trying to fight the prison administration to try to keep them from breaking my will. To me, this was a necessary fight because you cannot rehabilitate a man with a broken spirit. Breaking a man's spirit not only eliminates him as a threat, but it also kills his motivation to be productive. And productivity is a necessary part of rehabilitation. Consider this. I am a disabled person. I draw a disability check every month. If I wanted to, I could just lay around all day long and do nothing and still get paid. Yet I choose not to do this because I haven't lost my desire to be productive. Consequently, I put in more time doing volunteer work and being an advocate for social and community causes than 2 or 3 people working a 9-to-5. My desire for productivity is so great that I seldom have time for meaningful companionship with a woman. Every time I get involved with a female, she usually gets mad and ends up leaving me because I spend more time working on various projects than I do with her. I am tired of seeing women and children having to settle for men who have been broken down, marginalized, or otherwise destroyed by this system. So what I am trying to say is that when you go into a place like the Missouri State Penitentiary and you see a sign or anything else that says or suggests that you should leave all your hopes behind, there are really only 2 ways you can deal with a situation like this. Some people would just give up hope altogether, end of story. And that's exactly what the prison officials would want you to do. As long as the prisoner has a will of his own, he is always going to be considered a threat by those type of people. If not, why else would they even have a sign anywhere in any prison that would leave its occupants with such a discouraging message? Then there are people who go to prison and they see that message, but will say, I'll leave all the negative things behind to get me in the struggle. But if the time ever comes when I walk out of this place, I am going to leave here a better person than I was when I came in. And then when I get out, I am going to fight this system, not with guns, not with bullets, or other lethal weapons, but with intelligence. And I want my intelligence to be so ferocious, it will make this corrupt-ass system regret that they ever brought me to this place to begin with. That is the prison official's worst nightmare, and that is what I have been trying to do ever since I have been out. I want the prison officials and everybody like them to look at me and say, it was a terrible mistake locking him up in a place like that. You see, if they had left me out on the street, I might have eventually been corrupted by the criminal mentality. I might turn out to be a drug dealer, a drug addict, an alcoholic. I might have even got killed trying to hold up a liquor store or burglarize somebody's house. Or maybe I would be in prison with life or even a death sentence for murdering someone else. To be perfectly honest, I did narrowly escape a whole lot of those situations. But places like the Missouri State Penitentiary made me realize that the world already had enough killers. It already had enough gangsters, liars, thieves, con artists, robbers, drug dealers, and other criminals. And not all of them were in there with me behind bars. Many of them wore business suits, judicial robes, and uniforms. They carried briefcases, law books, badges, nightsticks, pepper spray, and firearms. And far too often, the people who worked in those type of places were more corrupt and far too difficult to rehabilitate than the people who were actually in there doing time with me. And that is why they don't believe in rehabilitation. Once I came to the realization that their job was to break a man's will and rob him of his dignity, I knew what my mission was, to try to educate myself and make sure that no matter what they did, they would never succeed in doing that to me. Unfortunately, not all of my fights were with prison administrators or other authority figures. I had my share of battles with other inmates in cells and out in the yard too. We fought because they bought into the slave master's lies, like slave-minded people often do. And those were the battles that I regret having to fight the most. They didn't accomplish anything except to hinder me in my struggle. Still, I will always believe that I outlived the Missouri State Penitentiary and that my hopes and dreams survived because I refused to let the DOC define who I am. Instead, I chose to define myself by believing in the good that was within me and not the bad things other people had to say about me and those who were incarcerated like me. To exemplify this to others as well as myself, I sometimes wear a handcuff key around my neck on a silver chain. People ask me why I do it, and I tell them it's for the same reason that Christians wear crosses around their necks. Jesus once said, what I have done, all men must do. What I am, all men shall be. So, just like the cross is a symbol of crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ, this handcuff key I wear is a symbol of my crucifixion, resurrection, and incarceration from the Missouri Department of Corrections. But please do not sit here and assume that my struggle to define or redefine myself is over. A convicted felon's reputation follows men and women for the rest of their lives, no matter where they go. There will always be some people who are never going to extend to us any credit, hire us as an employee, or let us live on their property, or otherwise be at ease around us. I am not naive, nor am I paranoid about this. And that is why I hurry up and tell people, everyone that I meet, that yes, I am a convicted felon. And then I say, if you've got a problem with that, let me know and I'll keep it moving, because I don't want to waste my time or yours. However, a whole lot of people don't seem to have a problem with formerly incarcerated persons anymore. There used to be a time when if I had told somebody I had been to prison, I would have had to brace myself for a negative reaction. Now, when I tell somebody that, most people just look at me and shrug their shoulders as if to say, so what? I have been out of incarceration for over 5 years now, and I have met hundreds of people. Yet I have not run into one single person who wasn't married to someone in jail, didn't have a father, a mother, a son, or daughter, or some other relative, or just a close friend in prison. If you stop and think about it, Missouri currently has 31,247 people locked up in their institutions. They've got 72,239 people on parole. That's not even counting all the people in this state who are locked up in county jails, in the federal system, and people like myself who are no longer on probation or parole. When you begin to consider these numbers, you have to ask yourself the question, who hasn't been to prison, or who doesn't have a friend or a relative in jail? Does that mean that everybody in this society has suddenly become a criminal? I doubt it. But it does make two things very clear. Everybody in prison can't possibly be guilty. And we are assured of that on this day by the presence of Mr. Robert Nelson and this wonderful woman, Ms. Sharon Snyder, who's had the courage to step forth and do the right thing. We are finding every day more and more people being exonerated who are in prison. But as Henry David Thoreau once said, in a society that imprisons men unjustly, the only place for a just man is in prison. It has also been said many times that when freedom is finally outlawed in this country, the real outlaws are the only ones who are going to be free. I just hope that is not the case. Still, it is the job of people like you and I to make sure that doesn't happen. And one thing is certain, we all see signs of such a day approaching, and it will happen. And then we all try to do something about it. Missouri Cure is trying to do something about it. It has been for 23 years. And that is why it has the name Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Arabs. So on behalf of all the people who are now incarcerated, and those of us who are no longer in prison like myself, I'd like to say thank you to Missouri Cure, and we appreciate everything you do. And now we come to the part of my presentation that I like to call the special page. Last month, August 21st, marked the 42nd anniversary of the death of George Jackson. For those of you who don't know who George Jackson is, he was a prisoner who was murdered in 1971 by guards at San Quentin Prison. While he was incarcerated, George was the author of two well-read books entitled Solidaire, Brother, and Blood in My Eye. He was killed in an alleged escape attempt, although it was obvious that he was murdered. The news of his death set in motion the infamous Attica Rebellion, one of the bloodiest riots in the history of America. George was also considered to be the instigator of a shootout that occurred at a California courthouse in which a judge, a prosecutor, a court clerk, and three would-be escapees were killed. Angela Davis was arrested, tried, and eventually acquitted for her alleged participation. And here's another little-known fact. The incident in California also inspired a similar attempt to rebellion in a near courthouse shootout right here in St. Louis, Missouri. And this time, an innocent man named Alvin Kersey Bailey was framed and wrongfully convicted. Every time Americans had an incident like this and authorities couldn't get their hands on those who were really responsible, somebody got framed. These are just other examples of what can happen when prison officials foster an atmosphere which encourages incarcerated human beings to leave all your hopes behind. So instead of putting up signs like the one at MSP, maybe we should put up some signs we say what George told us before he left this world. And what he said was this: there will be a special page in the Book of Life for the men who were brought back from the grave. This page will tell of utter defeat, ruin, passivity, and subjection in one breath, and in the next, overwhelming victory and fulfillment. So take care of yourself and hold on. Love, Calvin, and y'all.
And now I would like to welcome Kay Ray onto the airwaves of Sunset Reggae. And Kay Ray calls in every first Sunday of the month with his report from Behind the Fence.
This is Kay Ray coming to you on KKFI 90.1 with the monthly report from Behind the Fences. This is a segment where we on the inside let you on the outside know what is going on within corrections. And we encourage everyone to get involved with the issues concerning family, friends, and loved ones in prison. The topic for this month is the value of time served in prison. This refers to the way people serve time and how much time they are serving for the cost the taxpayers are spending. When a person is sent to prison by the courts, the sentence has two distinct parts. The first part is the retributive and deterrent portion of the sentence. This is the amount of time required to be served before the parole board may release a person to the outside. Quite naturally, if a person is serving a mandatory minimum sentence, such as 40%, 60%, 80%, or 85%, then those people cannot be released until this minimum amount of time is served. However, the majority of all other sentences require a third or 33 1/3 to be percent to be served before a person can be released by the parole board. All drug offenses do not have the mandatory minimums for repeat trips to prison. And the minimum, I believe, is 15% for the first-timers and 25% for the repeat drug offenders. In short, most people are required to serve 1/3 of their sentence before they can be released and re-enter society. The second portion of the sentence is the parole time, or the amount of time remaining on the sentence from the time of release until the end of the sentence. This is the reentry phase and supervised release of a prisoner. Now that we have established the length of time to be served, let us address the quality of time served by a prisoner. There are a few ways that you can do time while you're here. You can just do what it takes to get by, such as letting the caseworkers put you on the captain's crew job, which is basically walking around in an orange highway worker's vest while picking up cigarette butts and trash. Once this is your job, you will stay on the captain's crew until you get another job or go to the hole. The rest of the time, most people go to the gym or the yard when they can. Some sleep a lot and only get up for the meals. Now, more ambitious prisoners will apply themselves to getting their GED or a better job within the prison so that they can learn a trade while getting some semblance of a paycheck each month. In this prison, the most you can make would be at the panel factory during a busy month, which would be about $100 a month. It doesn't sound like a lot, but in here it is. Rest assured, those busy months are very few and far between. You may get one of those out of a year. Most of the time, it is only half days. This way of doing time is the most productive and results in an individual possessing marketable job skills to be used when released. The bottom line is some prisoners apply themselves to be productive, and some do not. Overall, the majority of people that are released are slated to return, as the parole board consistently keeps the productive prisoners while releasing the people who will soon return. Long gone are the days of respecting the amount of time a person has served or the way each prisoner chose to do their time. In the end, the parole board, the politicians, and the DOC have turned this into a massive fraud on the taxpayers, while not providing the service which this department was originally created. It is glaringly obvious that decisions are being made based on financial gain for the department and not on the public safety and welfare. I will leave you with an intriguing thought. If they are training dogs in the various prison dog programs throughout the state to do what they're supposed to do in 12 to 16 weeks, these dogs are trained well enough to be placed in people's homes on the street with children, then how do prisoners stay in prison so much longer if they are legally eligible to leave prison? Are we not trainable as humans? Or is it because the DOC gets $13,500 a year to keep humans in prison? Surely it is no longer just food for thought, but it's time to reform the way people are released from prison. Almost the entire country has got rid of the parole boards in their states for this reason alone. After attempting reform, only the parole board's removal was a viable option to stop the waste and corruption. I thank you for listening and encourage any or all of you to write into KKFI at P.O. Box 32250, Kansas City, Missouri, 64171 with questions or concerns regarding the issues on this program. Also, you may email Sister G at sunsetreggae.gmail. This has been K-Ray from Behind the Fences. Take care. God bless. Thank you and good night.
And we want to thank Sunset Reggae and Sister G for that commentary that she airs once a month on the first Sunday of the month. My name is Jeff Humfeld, and you are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio here on KKFI. And our guest now is Laura McDonald, Executive Director of More Squared. More Squared has been working on a bill that would lift the ban on folks with drug felony convictions being able to receive food stamps, as well as other legislation in the Missouri legislature. Welcome, Laura.
Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
This is the second year, I believe, that More Squares has been working on this bill, the food stamp bill. Would you tell us a little bit about how it did last year and where it is this year and whether we're making progress here?
Yeah, so just to give listeners a little background, Jeff, in 1996, as a part of welfare reform, President Clinton's administration encouraged states to ban people with drug-related felonies from being eligible for food stamps for the rest of their life. About 41 states adopted that ban at that time, and the only way to reverse it is through legislation. So we saw Kansas reverse this ban, I want to say 6 years ago, and we've been working on it here in Missouri. A number of us have worked on this for a number of years and seen many variations of legislation. You're right, More Squared started working intensively on it actually 2 years ago, and last year we saw this bill get out of the House as an amendment, but it was really late in session and it just didn't have time to get to the floor in the Senate for a vote. So this year, we have two bills. We have Senate Bill 680, sponsored by Senator Curl, who's from Kansas City, and we love the work that she's doing in corrections. Senator Curl's bill just last week was unanimously voted out of Senate committee. First time we've seen that get that far in Senate. Again, it has some provisions so people would have to prove their sobriety, but it would lift the lifetime ban that people face right now. We also have a House bill that's moving that's gotten huge bipartisan support. There's 19 co-sponsors, Republicans and Democrats. Wayland is the chief sponsor, and that's House Bill 1589 that also 2 weeks ago was voted out of committee with one no vote and everyone else voted yes. So we have two moving bills, one in the House and one in the Senate.
All right. Would you give those bill numbers once again and then tell people how they can get a hold of their legislator?
Yes. So Senate Bill 680. If Senator Curls is your legislature, we just want you to call her and tell her thanks for her support. The way that you can look up your senator is senate.mo.gov. If you're a Missourian, you just want to put in your zip code and it will tell you who your senator is. And you can email or call them. That's senate.mo.gov. And for House Bill 1589, that's house.mo.gov. And again, you just need to know your zip code and you can look it up right there on the homepage and call your member of House and encourage them to help get this bill to the floor for a vote now.
You will need to use that website. You will need the 11-digit zip code, the little four-number sub-zip code or whatever that they have, too, I believe, to actually get into your particular senator's or representative's website. We're going to be running short on time, but can you do a real quick rundown on some other bills that More Squared might be interested in?
So our primary interest this year, people who watch our organization or just pay attention publicly will know that our primary issue has been around public education right now. So I couldn't even begin to tell you all the legislation that is moving in House and Senate, particularly on Senate side that we're watching around our school district, and the fate of our district is certainly in the hands of the legislature as well as the state school board right now.
Right.
So that's our primary legislation
we're looking at
is this bill for criminal justice. And
Laura, I'm sorry, but we are out of time. We want to thank you for coming on and bringing our listeners up to date. A quick program note, next week on Jaws of Justice Radio, we will have a number of guests whose incarcerated loved ones are not getting the medical care they need. If you know someone or are in this position yourself, we will be opening the phone lines for your comments and advice as how to advocate for your loved one behind the walls. Tune in next week for a Jaws of Justice Radio call-in show. Up next is Liz Henry and Cassandra Mitchell. They talked to Greg Williams about his film, The Anonymous People. We will start out with an audio from the trailer of the film.
Whether we want to admit this or not, this is our black plague.
There's 25 million people that suffer from this illness.
We have an epidemic.
It's a national crisis that untreated addiction cost our economy over $550 billion last year.
It is disgraceful that we have done so little about it thus far.
Once you're an addict, you're that thing that they have to have.
So many people think of addicts as homeless people living under bridges.
The media is difficult for us to battle against because the negative news about addiction is dramatic.
You know what we in the media do? We wink-wink it. We Snoop Dogg it. Hey, oh yeah, they're stoned. That's fine.
If everyone thinks of alcoholism and addiction as a negative thing, no one's going to want to go get help.
As a culture, we are still very rooted in just say no.
Drugs are menacing our society.
We're going to try to incarcerate our way out of the addiction problem.
Our jails are full of addicts and alcoholics. They're all pulled up in one spot.
When you're caught, you will do time.
Recovery is what you need, not prison. Hello?
Alcoholism has too long been a taboo subject.
The shame and secrecy are just as deadly as the disease itself.
Our numbers are unbelievably strong, but yet we have no voice.
We know about every issue out there, but people don't know how important the issue of recovery is.
As a person in long-term recovery from an illness that has no cure, but an illness that has a solution.
If we could ever tap those 20 million people in long-term recovery, you changed this overnight.
Now it's my turn to teach you that recovery works.
History's on our side. History will show one day who and what we are. So I say we make history.
Voices are out there. We have to find and open the hearts. And I think those hearts want to be open.
I refuse to feel ashamed of who I am. I most certainly will not be embarrassed that I'm an addict. I'm going to tell whoever I damn well want to.
There's a lot of us. Everyone knows somebody.
Welcome to Recovery Talk on Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Cassandra Mitchell, and I'm here with Liz Henry. We are pleased to present filmmaker and creator Greg Williams of the documentary The Anonymous People. Welcome, Greg.
Hey guys, thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. We would like to start out. Would you tell us a little bit about yourself and your recovery journey? What kind of led you to the creating of the film?
Yeah, sure. I'm a young person in long-term recovery. Me, that means that I haven't used alcohol or other drugs in over 12 years. And so my recovery journey, I'm 30 today, not my birthday today, but I'm 30 as we speak today. But my recovery journey started when I was 17, and probably a little bit earlier than that. I grew up in Connecticut and got very addicted very quickly in my adolescence to pharmaceutical drugs, marijuana, alcohol, you know, starting at 12 years old and spent about 3 or 4 years of my life going from marijuana to you know, and alcohol to prescription drugs to OxyContin and really watching everything I thought about myself and everything my family thought about me start to unravel very quickly, where, you know, all of a sudden I'm having run-ins with the law, crashing cars, and, you know, doing a lot of things that I thought that I'd never do. I'm 12 years old, if you said, you know, you're going to be a liar, a thief, a manipulator, and those kinds of things, I never would have, I said that's not, you know, who I was going to become, but that addiction brought me to a place, and I nearly overdosed on a number of occasions, so I'm very lucky to be alive today, but I ultimately graduated high school, and that summer when I was 17 years old, was in a near-fatal car accident, and ended up going to treatment and, you know, learning about recovery, and at that point in time, you know, my addiction had taken me pretty deep, and so I became open to the idea of recovery, but meeting young people in recovery in that treatment program, and then, you know, a recovery house. I went to a recovery house after that, and that really laid the foundation of my recovery and got me very engaged in the 12-step community and, you know, interested in youth recovery. And I began supporting other young people in recovery during that journey, and that was all in Connecticut. And then that was over, you know, 12 years ago. I've been fired up about recovery ever since, and it's just, you know, it's been an evolutionary journey through that process to get to the place where we're opening the film theatrically in Manhattan on Friday night.
Wow, that's exciting. Congratulations.
That is really exciting.
Thank you guys for taking it and showing it down there. It's amazing.
Well, that was really exciting. I had told the story that a friend of mine from Atlanta that I knew from recovery circles got me connected with a couple of girls in Connecticut, Ellie and Amanda, who have Shining Strong Foundation, and had told me about the film. And then that's how I contacted you, and we were really excited to get it here. The showing was amazing. Just, you know, it just is inspiring to hear your story and to see the change in you. It sounds like has been phenomenal over the years. And then to get to the point where you felt led to create this film, and I know for me it's been a passion, the stigma and the shame and the hiding. And I grew up in a family where things just weren't talked about, not these sort of things, and had a grandfather who was an alcoholic, and my sister and I both are now in recovery, and it's an amazing journey. And then to hear other people come out and be vocal and talk and bring it out into the light, for me, has really been a miracle. Would you tell us a little bit about the film and kind of how you got started with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think your story parallels mine in a lot of ways. I mean, my first 5 years of recovery, I lived my recovery underground in a large respect because of not just, you know, personal shame, but you know, my community was ashamed, and I didn't think I could speak, and I didn't really know why I should speak. And but at the same time, my life is getting a lot better, and I'm seeing the impacts of this illness all around me, and not seeing the right solutions for families and young people going through this. And I went from this journey of secrecy. You know, I really kept a secret. I didn't tell my employers. I didn't tell a lot of people. I was just, you know, I'm a nicer guy when I don't drink, or, you know, I wouldn't really,
I'm
I would
allergic.
Make up stories or whatever. And I would hide the fact of the real, you know, reason that I'm in recovery. And I don't think I had the language that felt good to speak about my recovery, but I also don't think I knew why. And I met some people who you met in the film, these Carol McDade and Tom Coderre and Pat Taylor and these other folks in that you see in the movie, and they really sparked me and sparked me on this journey of taking my personal recovery experience and applying that to my citizenship and applying that to my advocacy on this issue and really understanding that my own personal journey of understanding this issue from a different lens, but also the power that my personal story has. And I think that's what people in recovery understand deeply is how powerful that personal story is, but not necessarily do they understand the power of our personal stories at the community level, at the cultural level. And that's the difference, is that, you know, a lot of the things that impact people from getting well from addiction are influenced at the community level and at the cultural level. And so the way to really change that and affect change on that issue is by sharing our stories on the radio like we're doing right now, or in the newspaper, you know, or at State House, or in those places where recovery isn't often brought to. Survivors and people in recovery from other illnesses are there every day of the week. They're in our newspapers. They're in our TV. We cherish, we celebrate breast cancer survivors, you know, people in remission from HIV and other things. And certainly addiction is a little bit different than some other issues, but it's not different in terms of the toll, the community toll, and then what the redemption brings to the community.
This is Liz. I just wanted to go ahead and share that for me, after seeing the film, you changed my relationship, or that, you know, that film changed my relationship with my own recovery. It made me actually feel probably more proud of being a recovering person.
Exactly.
And through the film, everybody who shared in the film, it educated me in a way that I hadn't been educated previously on addiction and recovery. And that was amazing and powerful and a huge gift. And that's why I'm so grateful for the film. It enhanced my recovery.
That's amazing to hear. Thank you for sharing that. And you know, I really appreciate that. And I will say that it's not, I put together this film, but it's really not, I don't feel like it's my film. I feel like I got inspired by some of these people and I wanted to tell their story. So I'm really humbled and grateful that I got an opportunity to tell their story. And that was really exciting. And I'm thrilled to hear that our stories are impacting other people.
Well, and that's part of you and your humility. And the thing is, you inspire me. I think you, because your commitment and your understanding how important it is to give back at such a young age kind of made me go, I need to do more.
Yeah, and I think, too, for me, I got sober at 39. I'm 41 now. And my sister got in recovery quite a few years before I did. And just to put a voice on who we are and what we're doing, and to not be ashamed for me, because I don't want my children. I brought them to see the film when we had it shown here, and my sons are 11 and 12, and it was just wonderful to have them be a part of it and to have them part of my recovery so we can break the cycle and we don't have another generation of kids hiding and not being able to talk about this disease. And for me, that's tremendous. And so what your film did was it brought that out into the light where I could share with people and say, yeah. And my mom's in long-term recovery. It's a beautiful thing to hear a 12-year-old say that.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about a generational family illness, no one told me at 12 years old that I had higher risk of addiction than other people. And so that's amazing. I can only imagine, because for years in our culture, in our community, whether your parents were addicted or in recovery, there was certainly a great deal of stigma placed on that to teenagers. So just imagine when the police officer comes into their school and tells them that you know, drug addicts and junkies are scumbags and they're talking about their parents. I cringe at thinking about what that does to a kid who's got a parent in recovery and or a parent who's still active in their own addiction. And it's really amazing how some of our efforts on this issue have really caused some unintended consequences.
Definitely. And if you're just tuning in, this is Jaws of Justice Radio, Recovery Talk with Cassandra Mitchell and Liz Henry. So as far as the film goes right now, you had a release in the United States through Gather Films, and now you said next week. What's going on with the film next week?
Yeah, it's really exciting. People can Google The Anonymous People, and it'll be the first thing that comes up. We've created a call to action around it, both manyfacesonevoice.org. And basically, because of grassroots demand, yourself and others taking on the initiative of bringing an independent film out into the world that doesn't have a marketing budget. We've shown all over the United States, Canada. We're starting to show in the rest of the world. It's really thrilling to see people and the passion that they have really want to organize their community and have community screenings around it. So we are releasing the film And because of that demand, we now are releasing the film theatrically in Manhattan. If we do well, the distributor might open it in more markets across the country. We have home video DVDs available. We have ways that you can screen the film on that website. So there's a lot of different ways to bring the film to your community. And hopefully in the next couple months, we'll also be available for download and iTunes and Netflix and Amazon and all of those other ways that people normally watch movies. So those distribution channels are only possible because of how big the recovery community is and how passionate people are who want to talk about solutions to addiction and not just have another film out there highlighting the sensational aspects of active addiction.
Exactly, and I think that was one of the things that drew me to it the first time I had seen the preview for it. I was mesmerized because it was looking at solutions. It wasn't looking at anything other than, you know, bringing it into the eyes of just regular people, and that there was hope and there was promise, and that the journey didn't have to end with being in jail, and you know, just moving people in a forward positive direction. You said relating it to things like AIDS, where, you know, you have to have a grassroots movement. You need people to step out and talk about it and not be ashamed. And I think for me, that's been a big part of this and a big part of seeing your film.
And also the other part of the film that really impacted me and has changed the way I talk about my recovery, and that was the part that I really grabbed onto, was that changing the language of recovery and using more of the words that I'm a sick person, I'm a person in remission, I'm responsible for my remission, and giving people those words and that power is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me was what really, I went to that training. We have that training in the film that Tom Coderre is teaching at.
Right.
And going to that training was really what unlocked the key for me in terms of feeling good about talking about my recovery. If I went to my state house or even a school, a high school, and I would say, you know, I'm Greg W., I'm a drug addict. While if I said that to you guys in a 12-step meeting, you might understand that I haven't used drugs in over 12 years. But no one ever taught me that if I said that not in those rooms where that language is understood, that people think I'm still getting high.
Right.
So I would say that to a teacher, I would say that to a classroom full of students, and that's the reaction. And that's public opinion research. Is I say I'm Greg W., I'm a drug addict, and that's their first reaction is that I'm still using. That's what our interpretation of that language is. Or if I'm in recovery, I'm trying to stop. And so that's where the piece of long-term recovery and some of that language piece is probably the most impactful thing that we can do in order to start to open up people's hearts, empathizing with new people and not attaching that baggage. It takes a long time to reclaim these words that our culture has really been dehumanized. I mean, we have a language that really dehumanizes people like us, and to transform that and give people an empowerment, person-centered language is really incredible, and it certainly changed my life.
My hope is that eventually people will look at recovering people with compassion and not judgment, and that's what the film and that's what the wording, that's my long-term hope, is that it's the start of that.
I'm totally with you, and that's all we need. Frankly, we don't need to convince everybody this is a disease, show pictures of the brain to everybody. Not everybody understands breast cancer, but everybody can identify with wearing a pink ribbon or understanding why it's important to support a cure for that illness. And so if we can open people's hearts to empathize with people as well, and not those people, that's when we're going to see massive change.
Cassandra and I have talked about this, because one of the things is still people say that the guy under the bridge with the paper bag full of liquor, and I'm thinking, I drank and used drugs for 16 years, and I never, ever drank with somebody under a bridge. I drank with people who lived in $500,000 houses and drove Mercedes.
It's not the perception that people have, and it is nice, and I do feel the more that I get out of my community and I talk to people and I say, you know, they ask what I'm doing. I'm actually studying to be a recovery counselor, and they ask, and I say, well, I'm in long-term recovery, and they kind of perk up and ask me a little bit more, well, I'm like, oh, I used to drink, but no, I don't anymore. And so then I get to explain to them in a way that kind of makes it not just real, but to put a face on it. And then I can't tell you how many people confide in me. Well, I have an uncle or a brother or a sister or a father or someone that, everyone's been touched. And just kind of to see the look on their face, to know that somebody understands and that somebody's not ashamed and is willing to talk to them. And I think that really does a lot. That says a lot. And the film did that for me. It's given me that voice, and I'm really appreciative of it. Thank you.
Are anyone that was in the film, are they going to be at any of the theatrical openings?
Yeah, in New York, we're definitely going to have a number of folks who are in the film at the theatrical opening in New York, both Friday and Saturday night. March 14th, we're opening for a week, so we're playing from March 14th to March 20th in New York City at the Quad Cinema on 13th Street. You can find out more information online or at our Facebook. And then hopefully, if all goes well, we'll be opening an additional market after that. Well, I got to get out to Kansas City and certainly let me know if you guys have another showing or community event or something like that. There are people in the film who would be willing to maybe come out to Kansas City and carry that message in person, for sure.
We would definitely love that. We are working with a couple of different recovery agencies in the community that Liz and I go and speak with and speak on the behalf of. And there's the Welcome House, which is a men's organization that houses men that are in recovery. And then there's First Call that Liz does work with, and just getting out and around, and that's kind of, we got your film out.
Maybe we could get you and William Cope Moyers to come in town. He writes a weekly column on creators.com. Have you ever read that?
Yeah.
He comes in town every once in a while.
Good, yeah. I don't know if I could keep up with William now. He's got quite the presence. I stand behind a camera for a living. William writes brilliantly, and not sure I can stand side by side and tell stories the way that man does. He's incredible. My favorite was the one around Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Right.
I mean, people haven't read it.
It's Phil, Bill, Jim, and I.
The unbelievable column that he wrote. It was really my favorite in the wake of the death of Mr. Hoffman, because of the way he compared how we did not shame James Gandolf in the same way that we shamed Philip Seymour Hoffman, and the way that, his father is supported through his journey of behavior change for his heart disease versus the way that William is supported for his behavior change for his addiction. It really articulated quite clearly for me the vision of where we can get to with addiction.
We're running out of time here. Would you please give us your the contact info as far as where people can look up information about the anonymous people?
Just the anonymous people. Just don't look for the hacker group, and we're the first thing that comes up. So the anonymous people and many cases onevoice.org. Either way you spell it, it's fine. Our trailer's right there, but we're not hard to find. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook or Twitter, and definitely, there's a way to bring your film to your community. So if people in Kansas City have not seen it, maybe you guys are going to gather another one. That opportunity is still out there for a few more months, certainly, in September's recovery month. So maybe there's some event planning to do for that.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks again, Greg Williams. We appreciate your time and hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you.
All right, guys.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Ready? One, two, three. Sitting here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know. Maybe I'm supposed to cry. If nobody ever knows the way I feel, that's all right.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We thank our engineer Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clemmer on Thursdays, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Echo Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following segment courtesy Fox.
All right, should cops be allowed to enter your home if your roommate gives them permission? The Supreme Court has said yes.
Yeah, police officers will now have more leeway to search homes without obtaining a warrant, even in situations where there's no emergency. Does this decision scale back our rights? Let's ask one man who knows, Fox News senior judicial analyst, Judge Andrew Napolitano. Judge, great to see you this
morning.
Good
to see you.
Does this court's ruling really create potential for abuse by police?
Well, yes, it does. And I'm not happy about it. And those of us who believe that the Constitution means what it says shouldn't be happy about it. So here's what happens. The police are called to a house because of a domestic disturbance. And they knock on the door and there's a man and a woman. They say, can we come in? The woman says yes, the guy says no. Now at that point,
yes wins.
At that point, no wins. The law before this case was, if anybody says no, it's no.
Oh.
The guy gets in a fight with the police drag him out, he's arrested. They go back to the house and they say, can we come in? It's just the lady there. She says yes, even though the guy said no, he's no longer there. They go in, they find guns, they find evidence of drugs, and these people are prosecuted. They moved to dismiss the charges because the police didn't have the right to come in. So before this case, if one said yes and one said no, it was no. After this case, if one says yes and one says no, and the one who says no is no longer there, you still with me?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's yes, the police can come in. Here's the abuse. The police can arrest the person who says no, get him off the scene, and they are left with the person saying yes, and use that as a means to get on the property. That's the danger with this decision.
Sure, because the second rat who saw the first rat getting eaten does not want to be in that same situation and feel pressured, even if they did not want
Correct.
To say
no, this
yes.
This can only happen when you have more than one person there. They can't go to the Kilmeade household and see the gardener and say, can we come in? And the gardener says yes, and Mrs. Kilmeade says no. I'm making this up. This would never actually happen.
Right, because we don't have the gardener in the house.
Right, it has to be someone who appears to have control over the house. It can't be the gardener.
So but two people on a lease, this would be the situation if only one person is on a lease.
Yes. Right. Now, from the police perspective, they don't know who owns the house.
Right.
They don't know who the tenants are. They don't know what the relationship between these people are. Is she his visitor? Is she his wife? Does she own the house? Is he the visitor? So
What about broader issues over cell phone searches and NSA surveillance as it relates to allowing access to a house?
You know, here's the reason I'm a little agitated, because prior to this decision 2 days ago, the court was moving more in the direction, I'm doing this because I know he's not crazy about this, of privacy.
Just how many of our basic constitutional rights do we want to give up to this drug war? Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.